the Bogdani case file. And no, she didn't, not entirely. She said maybe coffee, remember? So I thought I'd give her a second crack at the goods. It would be a shame for her to miss out on this.
He indicated his conventionally good-looking features.
Who wouldn't want to experience a law-enforcing love god?
Rachel was about to name some people for whom this might not be an enticing prospect when she was distracted by her phone bleeping. It was a text from Stuart.
Hi, Ray. I'm in London for a couple more days and I'd still like the chance to talk properly before I leave. It would help us both to close this chapter, I think. I wondered if you'd like to meet up again. I have a couple of tickets for Covent Garden tonight. La Traviata. I have a box.
Rachel sighed, as if mentioning the cost of the seats would swing it. Sorry, I'm on ops at the moment.
Well, it was true. But even if it hadn't been, she would have come up with some excuse. She had blanked out the strange and abrupt ending of their marriage for so long that it seemed impossible to make things right by discussing it further, especially in an opera box. She just wanted to sign the divorce papers and be done. By the time Andy Whittier appeared with the rest of the early shift, Brickell had munched his way through the crisps, the chocolate and half the biscuits, and they were both starting to get restless. Andy walked out of the warehouse waving cheerfully to a couple of colleagues who were leaving at the same time and climbed into his car. But he didn't drive off. He sat and waited. An hour later, it was almost dark. Andy was still sitting motionless in his car.
"What the fuck's he doing?" grumbled Brickell. "Why hasn't he left?"
"That's kind of the point of surveillance, to find out."
"Sod this, I need a slash."
He disappeared for 10 minutes and came back with a kebab and chips, which filled the car with the smell of fried onions. By 7:45, the last of the late shift workers were leaving, but Andy was still in his car. Gradually the car park emptied, and the lights in the building were extinguished, one by one. A uniformed security guard arrived and positioned himself in a booth at the front of the building. At the exact moment Andy Whittier left the car, walked round to the back of the building and disappeared from view.
"He's gone back in again,"
observed Brickell through a mouthful of Maltesers.
"No shit, Sherlock." "Oh, hold on."
Rachel pointed as discreetly as possible. "Who's this?" A battered estate car drove up and a familiar figure got out.
"Bingo,"
she said with satisfaction. "It's brother Gavin."
Gavin also disappeared around the back of the building, out of sight of the security guard.
Brickell hastily tossed the bag of chocolates onto the back seat with the congealed remains of the kebab, now fully alert. A few minutes later, the men came out together, with Gavin carrying something wrapped in a bright blue plastic tarpaulin. It was several feet in length, not heavy enough to need both men, but bulky enough to slow his movements.
"Oh, Christ," breathed Brickell, "surely not."
Andy opened the hatchback on the estate, and Gavin carefully laid the bundle down inside before climbing into the driver's seat. Andy headed back to his own car.
"My favourite," said Brickell,
starting the engine and sliding skillfully and silently forwards.
"Car chase!"
They followed the two cars at a discreet distance to a small modern housing development, not far from where Terry Harper lived. Both cars came to a stop outside a brick townhouse. Gavin's car parked on the drive in front of the integral garage. Andy stopped at the curb. Rachel and Brickell watched as the package, which must have weighed 50 pounds or so from the way it was carried, was taken carefully in through the garage door. It was then closed, and both men remained inside.
"Shit," said Brickell. "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?"
Rachel nodded.
"Are there vests in the car, or tasers?"
He shook his head. "Nah, didn't think we'd need them."
"Well, you should have thought about that," said Rachel tersely. "That's your job."
"It's going to be a call for backup, then,"
said Brickell, taking out his airwave handset.
"We need an ARV.
Look on the bright side. At least Gavin and Andy have no idea we're here. That buys us some time.
20 minutes later, a police support unit arrived in a van. Armed officers hammered on the front door while others stood ready with their tubular steel-enforcing battering rams. Red keys, the uniformed officers called them. A confused-looking young woman in an old T-shirt and pyjama bottoms opened the door, and members of the tactical unit swarmed past her, making their way to the garage. Rachel held up her warrant card. "Are Andy Whittier and Gavin Harper here? They're watching the football, but..."
Rachel and Brickle pushed past her into the living room. Both men were already on their feet, startled by the noise, and both recognised Rachel. "What's going on?" Gavin asked, the colour draining from his face. "Have you found her?"
"We need to conduct a search of the premises,"
Brickle said, as two heavy-booted officers thundered upstairs to prove his point.
"Hold on," said Andy. "My kids are asleep up there. They'll be terrified."
Rachel held up her hand, indicating to the officers upstairs that they should wait on the landing.
"We need to have a look in your garage."
Andy paled and exchanged a stricken look with Gavin.
Brickle had already gone through the connecting door in the utility room. Rachel followed, with the two brothers hovering in the doorway.
"Here it is."
Brickle pointed to a blue bundle against the far wall. He ripped the synthetic tarpaulin away, revealing a thick polythene bag containing what looked like small metal bricks.
"What the fuck?"
Rachel knelt down and ripped at the polythene bag with the Swiss Army knife she always carried, taking out one of the metal ingots and examining it.
"It's rhodium," said Andy,
who was now standing behind her.
"Corrosion resistant, used in catalytic converters and spark plugs."
"And worth nearly £1,000 an ounce," observed Rachel. "Mind telling us what you were doing removing this from your work premises and hiding it here?"
"It's my fault," said Gavin. "Andy knew I was up to my eyeballs in debt and needed to make some decent money in a hurry, so we thought we could sell it on the black market."
"You do remember that you're already on bail for a fraud offence and being investigated over your daughter's disappearance?"
Rachel's tone was flat, the adrenaline leaching from her body. Andy turned on her.
"How the hell did you know about this?" he demanded.
"Followed you," Brickle said bluntly, taking a set of handcuffs from a member of the armed unit. "We thought you might be hiding Lola Jade."
He cuffed Gavin's wrists behind his back.
"Gavin Harper, I am arresting you on suspicion of burglary. Contrary to Section 25 of the Theft Act, you do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence."
"I didn't take Lola,"
Gavin shouted angrily.
"I didn't take her, and I don't know who did. I thought you got that."
Rachel cuffed Andy and cautioned him, and the two of them were loaded into the back of the armed response vehicle, along with a consignment of rhodium.
"Take him to the nearest nick and have him booked and banged up. Make sure they know Harper's already on bail,"
Brickle told the unit commander.
"We'll speak to the custody sergeant and their CID in the morning."
He thumped the back door of the van, giving the driver his cue to set off.
"Well, that was fun," he said with evident satisfaction. "Been a while since I've done a spot of smash and grab. Beats being stuck behind a desk all day."
Rachel was shaking her head, reaching into her bag for a painkiller and washing it down with a can of Coke left over from the stakeout.
"But Lola's still missing. We're back to the drawing board."
Chapter 14.
"Fancy a curry?"
Rachel stared at Brickle in disbelief. "A curry? You've just had a kebab and chips."
He shrugged. "So, I'm a growing lad." Rachel considered for a minute. On the one hand, she was quite hungry, having only eaten a handful of Maltesers since breakfast. On the other, her widowed mother lived around 15 minutes away in Purley, not far off the main A road into London, and her conscience was pricking her. She hadn't visited for several months.
"I think I'm going to spend the night at my mum's," she said firmly, programming the address into the car's sat-nav. "Drop me off there and I'll get a train in tomorrow morning. I think we're long overdue a chat with the original Surrey police case team, so I might go there first. You never know, it could shed some light." Parked on the leafy street outside her mother's bijou 1930s suburban house in Purley was a familiar silver people carrier. Rachel grimaced.
Oh, shit, Lindsay, what perfect timing.
Who's Lindsay?
My big sister, who never misses the opportunity to point out what a crap daughter I am.
Shall I come in with you? Give them something more interesting to talk about.
Rachel smiled and patted Brickle's thigh briefly, then swiftly retracted her hand. The two of them tended to avoid physical contact, sticking to sibling-type joshing instead.
Thanks, but I wouldn't inflict that on anyone, not even you.
Not too late to turn round and make a quick getaway.
He slammed down to first gear and revved the engine to illustrate his point.
No, I'm going to do the decent thing.
Rachel hobbled up the front pathway with Brickle watching her. She was very stiff and would have loved to head to the gym in Bermondsey instead. Not too late to run back to the car, jump in and order Brickle to floor it. But the net curtains in the front room were already twitching at the sound of a car's engine and the front door opened.
Well, 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 we are honoured.
Lindsay stood there, her arms folded. The outline of her henpecked husband, Gordon, loomed behind her. Rachel leaned in and kissed her sister on her cool, dry cheek.
I was working on a job nearby, she offered.
Some of us don't need an excuse to drop in, Lindsay sniffed.
But then some of us aren't high-flying detectives.
Who's that? Called Eileen Prince.
It's me, Mum.
Don't worry, we're not going to stay and spoil the prodigal's visit, Lindsay said waspishly. Gordon's been fixing a leak under the kitchen sink, but it's done now, so we'll be off in a minute.
Lindsay was 9 years Rachel's senior. They had not really enjoyed a shared childhood, and now in adulthood, the same absence of closeness prevailed. Lindsay had left home when Rachel was 10, and 6 years later married a dull quantity surveyor called Gordon Reynolds. They had two timid teenagers called Tom and Laura, whose birthdays Rachel was perpetually forgetting, a golden Labrador and membership of the National Trust. They went on camping holidays, sang in a madrigal group, and sent round-robin letters at Christmas, with Lindsay still finding time amidst all this wholesome activity to emit disdain for Rachel's self-centred, unencumbered life. Later, when they were alone, Rachel and her mother made beans on toast and ate them on their laps in front of a cookery show, washed down with mugs of Horlicks, a comfortable and familiar ritual. Eileen, who had noticed her daughter limping slightly in the kitchen, asked her about her leg.
I did it when I was out for a run. It's nothing, really.
Eileen fussed about fetching her a footstool, cushion and ice pack.
You and your jogging, she sniffed.
Rachel slept like a hibernating bear in her childhood bed, under a faded candlewick bedspread, surrounded by posters of Chesney Hawks and the Backstreet Boys. At 8:30 sharp, the orthodox time for breakfast, according to Eileen Prince, she endured a fry-up so huge that she was left bloated and dyspeptic. When she arrived at Eastwell Police Station, she was sure they would be able to smell the lard and bacon fat seeping from her pores. It was a test of her affection for her mother and filial guilt that she had not pushed it away in disgust and demanded a grapefruit instead. She planned to avoid eating for the rest of the day to redress the balance. The desk sergeant told her that the only on-duty member of CID who had covered the Harper case was currently interviewing a suspect in a burglary. Rachel elected to go off in search of coffee, and on her return was met in reception by an attractive and visibly pregnant young woman with a curtain of shiny dark hair and a calm, intelligent aura. She extended a hand.
We've already spoken on the phone. I'm Leela Rajavi.
Rajavi confirmed that the suspect she had just interviewed and remanded was none other than Gavin Harper.
He's admitted the theft of the rhodium from his brother's workplace, she told Rachel. And Andrew Whittier admitted to being an accessory. That much was straightforward.
But the value of the rhodium was another matter. We're trying to work it out now, but it looks like it could be as much as 500,000.
So, a Category 1 offence then, said Rachel with a sigh. Great. This development added another layer of complication to their investigation of Gavin's involvement with Lola Jade's disappearance.
Rajava's expression was half exasperated, half resigned. Anne's already being on bail for the identity document fraud charge won't exactly help his case. He's looking at between 3 and 6 years in all probability. Whittier could get 1 to 2. If the judge allows that Gavin's behaviour is down to upset caused by the disappearance of his daughter, then he might also get away with 1 to 2 years. Let's hope he's got a good brief. Rajavi gave a brisk professional smile. Now, what can I do to help with Lola Jade Harper? Any solid leads?
Rachel shook her head at the machine tea in a polystyrene cup, offered by a young plainclothes officer with pale blonde hair and protruding ears, who was introduced to her as DC Matt Coles.
As you know, we tracked down Gavin Harper in Portugal, and of course we'll go on looking into his possible involvement in Lola Jade's abduction while he's a guest of Her Majesty.
She spoke with more confidence than she was feeling. Our child protection unit are also making inquiries overseas. It's still possible that she was snatched to order and taken out of the country. Obviously, in light of recent events, they're going to be focusing on Portugal.
Rajavi was shaking her head slowly.
You don't agree?
I was there at the mother's house for the original search. It was obvious that the child had been taken from her bed, but there were no signs of forced entry downstairs. Michelle said that she must have gone to bed and left the patio door unlocked. It was a warm evening, so that's possible, but... She hesitated.
Go on.
If a child's going to be abducted to order, it's got to be planned. They're not going to be able to rely on a downstairs door being conveniently left open. I don't know. We searched the place from top to bottom the day she was reported missing, and a couple of weeks later they went in with cadaver dogs, but there was nothing. No sign of a struggle, no sign she was harmed in any way. And it would have been really difficult for a stranger to get her out of the property without waking Michelle. That was the major reason for going with the theory that the father had taken her. If she woke up and saw him in her bedroom, she wouldn't have been scared. She'd have gone with him. And he could easily have had a key.
He'd have needed a car. Was anything picked up on CCTV?
Rajavi shook her head. The council have a camera at the corner of Sycamore Drive, just where cars come in and out of the estate from the main road. But they'd been lax with their maintenance and it wasn't working that night.
Rachel tapped her pen against her notebook. Okay, bit of a long shot. But do you know anything about the death of the Harper's son, Oliver, in 2008?
Rajavi nodded slowly. I'd only just joined as a WPC then, but I do vaguely remember something about that. It came up when Lola went missing. Would you like me to find the file?
She returned a few minutes later, and Rachel glanced through it, but there were only duplicates of the reports that had been on the divorce file.
My colleague Debbie Mount was one of the officers that went to the scene, Rajavi offered. She said there was something off about it.
In what way?
Something about Michelle Harper's reaction that didn't seem right. How she kept embellishing the story, went into minute detail about the baby's schedule for the whole of the previous 24 hours, as if she'd rehearsed it. Said he'd had a sore ear, then changed it to a cough. When Debbie pointed this out, she claimed he'd had both and got quite uppity about it. And she was the same when her daughter disappeared. If anyone said something she didn't like, she became overly defensive, almost aggressive. I distinctly remember when we heard about Lola Jade, Debbie saying, "Oh, she's the one with the dodgy cot death."
But the pathology was inconclusive. Sadly, it usually is in sudden infant death.
Rajavi shrugged. I'm not saying there was any evidence on which to proceed, but
there was a suspicion.
Exactly.
Rachel blagged a lift to Willow Way in a uniformed patrol car, asking the constable to drop her out of sight of number 57. The precaution was redundant, however, as once again the house was empty.
She rang the doorbell and peered through the living room window, but it appeared exactly as it had been before, tidy but neglected. The side gate was bolted, but a sharp jab with her shoulder opened it and let her into the garden. There was a plastic swing at the far end of the lawn, grimy with lack of use, and in the shed was a lilac and white child's bike that didn't look as though it had ever been ridden. The garden was backed by a 10-foot-tall brick wall, forming part of a purpose-built garage block for some of the smaller properties in the adjoining street, confirming Rachel's assumption that the only way out of the property was via the front door. Number 57 was link-attached by the garage to its identical neighbour, and from the old-fashioned potting shed, pond and kitch garden ornaments, Rachel guessed its residents were older than the Harpers. She approached the front porch, proudly decked with pots of dahlias. And then she saw it. A CCTV camera. It was almost completely obscured by a thick creeper that wound up the front of the house, between the garage and the front door, and you had to look hard to see it. But nevertheless, there it was, pointing towards the shared driveways and the street. Rachel rang the bell, and an elderly woman answered it. She was plump and rounded and rather hunched. Rachel was reminded of Beatrix Potter's Mrs. Tiggywinkle. She showed her warrant card and asked if she could have a quick word. "I expect it's about that little girl," the woman said with satisfaction. "Come on through, dear." "And you are?" "Mrs. Lewis, Marjorie." "Do you live alone?" "No, dear, my husband's still in the land of the living." She gave a throaty little chuckle. "He's out in his shed. Norman. Shall I fetch him?" "Yes, please." "Drinking a biscuit for your detective?" Rachel refused the biscuit, her stomach still gurgling from its intake of fried food, but accepted a glass of weak barley water. Norman Lewis came in and introduced himself, declining to shake hands on account of the soil on his. He was also rotund and rosy-cheeked, and wore a battered moleskin waistcoat. A perfect Mr. Tiggywinkle. "We used to see little Lola playing out with the other kiddies in the close," Marjorie said without preamble. "Didn't we, Norm?" He grunted, "when her mother would let her." "Yes, Michelle was never very keen on letting her out of her sight. Didn't seem to like her having friends." "Really?" asked Rachel. "Do you know why?" Marjorie pursed her lips. "You don't like to talk badly about someone going through such an ordeal, but she could be a bit difficult, couldn't she, Norm, Michelle Harper?" Norm nodded, chewing a Garibaldi. "You never quite knew where you were with her. Sometimes she was nice as pie. Sometimes she just looked daggers, wouldn't she?" Norm affirmed that this was the case. "And the other kids. I'm on friendly terms with Lynn at number 49. She's got little ones. They never went round to next door to play, did they? They were all scared of Michelle. She used to shout at them, apparently, and..." "I wanted to ask you about your security camera," Rachel interjected. "How long have you had it?" Marjorie looked at her husband. 6 months, is it, Norm?"
7.
"So you had it at the beginning of May?"
"Yes, definitely," said Norman, spraying crumbs. "Our Philip put it up when he was here for Easter lunch."
Rachel discreetly offloaded her glass of squash behind a pot plant and leaned forward. "Did the police ask to see footage at the time?"
"I don't think so."
Marjorie sought confirmation from Norman again.
"A young policeman came round here to talk to us the next day when they were doing their house-to-house inquiries. There were several of them out there in the close. But they didn't ask about the camera, no. And we didn't think to say anything, did we?"
She looked guilty. Rachel's heart sank slightly. Most domestic CCTV cameras automatically wiped footage within 4 weeks. But Marjorie suddenly perked up, having thought of something.
"Oh, Norman, what was it Philip said about the backup thingy?"
She turned to Rachel. "Our son set it all up for us. He's the one who's a computer whiz. We know nothing at all about the things.
But I do remember there was something about the recordings being saved to a computer file thingy. Would I be able to speak to your son? He lives in Morden, but I expect he'd be happy to talk to you. They come down for Sunday lunch sometimes, but he works ever so hard. Both he and Sally work, so we don't tend to see them in the week. Sometimes we have the grandkids to stay to give them a break, Felix and Finley. They love it because they get a bedroom each. They have to share one at home, with their parents using one for an office. But we've got the two spare rooms, so... Rachel interrupted Marjorie's spiel by standing up and reaching into her bag. She handed over one of her cards, which was accepted and clutched with great reverence. "Give your son my details and ask him to phone me as soon as he gets a minute." Chapter 15.
"Whoa, easy, Tiger." Howard stepped backwards and ducked out of the way as Rachel sent flying kicks at the punch ball. "I know your leg's improving, but I don't think you're ready to cross over into kickboxing."
Rachel dropped her leg and slumped her shoulders. "Sorry, I've had a bit of a day." It had started with a visit to Patton's office, fired up and brimming with confidence. After updating her superior officer, she had told him with utter conviction that the next step for the investigation was to put Michelle Harper under covert surveillance. She was adamant that if her husband was anywhere, he'd be in Spain. And yet he was in Portugal. It feels to me like a classic piece of misdirection. Patton had looked doubtful. "She could just have been mistaken." "Perhaps, but she lied to us about why Gavin had one of Lola's nighties with him. It's as if she's trying to shift blame in his direction." He had thought this over before saying... "Even supposing you're right, I'd still need something more tangible to go on, given how expensive 24-hour surveillance is, something I can give to the money men upstairs." He'd pointed upwards to an invisible finance department. "Otherwise, I don't think I can get the requisite manpower budget signed off." "All right," agreed Rachel, who had more or less expected this. "How much do you need?" "Come on, Detective Inspector, you know how this works. I need actual evidence that points to the mother, not just a bad feeling about her. Find me something concrete and we'll take a closer look at her." Rachel's mind had been working like a hamster in a wheel ever since, which was why she had taken herself off to the gym, to try and refocus.
"Want to talk about it over a drink?"
Howard asked as they headed out of the building, both still in their kit with sweaty towels draped over their shoulders. She shook her head. "I'd love to, but I need a shower and then I've got some work I have to do." He stopped her in her tracks and turned her to face him.
"Did you mean that?"
"What?"
"That you'd love to have a drink with me."
Rachel was not about to tell him how ridiculously pleased she had been to see him when she had arrived at the gym that evening. That she'd been low on attractive male company recently, and that in her estimation, Howard was definitely attractive. Despite swearing off men, it would be fun to sit in a pub or bar with him for a couple of hours. "Yes, I would, but you're married." He smiled his easy smile. "It's just a drink, not a joint bank account." She shuddered, remembering Stuart, who had sent two more unanswered texts that day. "Never planning on having one of those again. Not ever." He raised an eyebrow. "Really?" "Long story. I'll tell you about it another time. Maybe." She reached up on tiptoe to kiss his cheek. She was tall, but he was a giant, and hurried away before she changed her mind. Back at her flat, she took a long hot shower, poured herself a glass of wine, and started to trawl through social media. Maybe Michelle Harper had left a digital crumb trail that could lead to something concrete. She found an early Instagram account opened in 2012, which only had a dozen or so posts on it. One of the first was of a crying toddler Lola with her earlobes newly pierced with diamante studs and the caption, "She hated it, but she'll thank me when she's older." The picture had attracted 123 comments, not many of them favourable. "OMG, this is not okay,"
one critic had posted. "She is way too young for this. Child abuse," said another. There were several others in the same vein. Eventually, Michelle had responded, "I'm the parent. She is my child. I get to make all decisions regarding her until she is 18 years old. You haters need to remember, I made her. I own her."
"Sit on the fence, why don't you?" Rachel muttered at the screen.
There were some very filtered selfies of Michelle pouting at the camera like a pantomime cow, a handful of pictures of Diva the dog, and a few more of Lola. They were posed rather than natural action shots, and in all of them the child was staring wanly at the camera. All fairly enlightening, but it wasn't evidence. Frustrated, she Skyped Brickle. He was bare-chested above tracksuit bottoms and eating a slice of pizza. So far, so normal.
"What do you always tell me is the first rule of detecting?" he asked Rachel after she had vented her frustration.
"Go with your gut."
"Okay, then, maybe not the first rule. What's the second rule?"
She shrugged. He tapped the side of his nose.
"Follow the money. We know her old man is in all sorts of financial shit. So what's the deal with Michelle? How's she funding herself? Who's paying for all those tacky hair extensions? Sex, revenge and money. The big three motives. So why not go with the money and see where it takes us? Is there some sort of reward she could be scamming?"
He leaned back on his sofa with a look of self-satisfaction and wiped pizza crumbs from his naked torso. It wasn't a bad torso either, Rachel was forced to acknowledge. Who knew sculpted abs like that could be created solely from junk food? An all-too-familiar spark fired in her brain. "Hold on. You just reminded me of something. See you in the morning." She hung up before he could respond and pulled up the Find Lola Jade page on Facebook. There'd been little activity since she'd last checked it. People were losing interest. Then she clicked on the link to the Just Giving page. The donations now stood at £53,316. Rachel phoned the NCA and asked to be put through to the on-call IT officer. It was a man called Lee Knightley, someone she had worked with before. "Hi, Lee, it's Rachel Prince. Listen, if I send you a crowdfunding link, can you get into the account?"
"Shouldn't be a problem. Whack it over and I'll give it a go."
An hour later, Lee phoned her back. "Okay, I'm looking at the page now. Total raised £53,316. Available funds, £23,316. Your withdrawals, £30,000. Raised since last withdrawal, £5,353.
When was that money withdrawn?
There was a pause while Lee looked for something. The account was opened on the 12th of May and the 30 grand was taken out on the 17th, pretty much as soon as the total hit the 30k mark. Most of the donations were made within that first week, but funds have continued coming in between 1 and 3 grand a month since the account was first opened. The total displayed on the landing page is the entire amount raised, not a current balance.
Rachel's heart was beating a little faster. And the withdrawal went to Michelle Harper?
Yes, to her linked bank account.
Okay, Lee, I need you to get into that account and go through all her transactions since the 10th of May. Try and work out where those funds went. Send anything you find to my work email and call me back on this number.
Tonight? Lee was doubtful. It might take me a couple of hours.
Yes, tonight. It doesn't matter how late it is.
He eventually phoned at 12:15. It turned out her detective sergeant had been right, as he so often was. She went straight to Patton's office the next morning, only pausing long enough to print off Lee Knightley's email.
"Oi, what's going on?" grumbled Brickall as she brushed briskly past him, barely incapacitated by her right knee now. "Tell you later."
If she had expected Nigel Patton to become fired up by this information, she was wrong. He frowned at the email and then back at her.
"So, Michelle Harper legitimately withdrew funds from a crowdfunding account that was set up to benefit her. You'll have to forgive me, but I don't see this as significant.
one of the first things any would-be detective learns, D.I. Prince, evidence of bad character is not evidence of a crime.
Rachel tried to contain her exasperation. She funneled the money into her own bank account, then immediately withdrew the same amount, £30,000, in cash. Cash! She's got barely any income of her own and is drowning in credit card debt. So where's that £30,000 gone? And how does it relate to her daughter's disappearance? I think there's a clear question to be answered.
Patton sighed and rested his chin on his hands, thinking. All right, I'll speak to Ops and get some surveillance put in place. But obviously, given that your primary role is international liaison, I want you to make that your priority. You've re-interviewed the father since he got back?
Yes, but he's sticking to his story. There's not going to be any more intel coming from him direct.
So you need to trace his movements.
I can't do that, sir. He's now banged up on theft charges.
I meant back in Portugal. I want you to get yourself out to the Algarve. Head up a team and keep looking out there until you find the girl.
Did Patton pull one of his classic you're-off-the-case moves?
Brickell was trying to read Rachel's expression as they headed out of the building to the Pin and Needle for a much-needed liquid energy boost.
Not exactly. He wants me to go back and poke about in Albufeira.
Another jolly in the sun. Cheers!
He clinked glasses with her. Rachel scowled. I'd much rather be following up on Ops this end.
Tough. So, you divorced yet?
Rachel shook her head. I'm too busy avoiding my husband to divorce him. Brickell grinned.
Do I smell a last-minute change of heart? Will we be hearing the patter of tiny feet before too long?
Before she had the chance to formulate a smart comeback, Rachel's phone rang, an unfamiliar number.
Hello, is that Detective Prince?
Speaking.
This is Philip Lewis.
Rachel was momentarily blank.
You spoke to my parents, Marjorie and Norman, about their CCTV recordings.
Oh, yes, thanks for calling back. I know it's a long shot, given the incident was several months ago, and you probably no longer have anything from that period.
Oh, I do, he said pleasantly but firmly. I set up a program that automatically archives all footage. We've got every bit of it.
Chapter 16. I'm in computer programming, you see, said Philip Lewis, so it was relatively simple for me to create this system.
Looking at him, Rachel could quite easily believe it. She had expected the son of Mr. and Mrs. Tiggywinkle to be similarly short and rotund, but he was all bony angles with a shaved head and Thunderbird's glasses. She had arranged to meet him in Willow Way, and his parents were waiting anxiously on the patio in the garden, as if afraid to come into their own house. Their son spoke to them in a hectoring, even bullying tone, which probably explained this. Philip led Rachel up to the smallest of the spare rooms, no bigger than a box room, which housed a child-sized single bed and a small desk with a computer monitor and an upright hard drive underneath it. He showed her the active monitoring pictures in real time, then found the relevant file in a folder on the computer's desktop.
There was a spate of break-ins at the beginning of the year, and my parents were understandably worried about it. I told them they should sell the house and move nearer to Sally and me in Morden, but they wouldn't countenance it.
He didn't attempt to hide his disapproval of this decision, so I set up this security system.
And I'm very grateful for your expertise, said Rachel smoothly. She'd been accused of acting cool and over-analytical in the past.
But let it never be said she didn't know how to schmooze a witness.
Yes, well, he cleared his throat. My youngest is around the same age as the little girl, and you can only imagine. So obviously, anything I can do to help find her.
He clicked on the file labelled 9517_backup, and pressed play. The night images were black and white, but very clear, and Philip explained at tedious and self-important length why this was the case, with a lecture on image resolution and pixels.
The lens of the camera picked up the shared driveway between numbers 57 and 55, and the shot also covered the front door of the Harper's house, the pathway that led to the side gate and garden, and a section of the road in front. In short, anyone entering or leaving the house would have been picked up by the Lewis's camera. Philip fast-forwarded through all the footage for that night, but there was no activity bar an urban fox rooting around the bins.
"Interesting, isn't it?"
he observed with evident smugness.
"Mrs. Harper claims someone must have come into the house via the patio door, but that's not possible, given the only access to the gardens of number 57 and 55 is through the houses themselves."
"Hmm," Rachel was non-committal. "An intruder could potentially have climbed over the top of the garage block and jumped down into the garden. It was doable, by someone fit. To return the same way carrying a young child would be a lot harder, though. Impossible for a single intruder. If, indeed, Lola had been stolen to order, there had to have been more than one person involved."
The next day's footage, in colour, showed the arrival of a police squad car at 7:12 a.m. Then the comings and goings of Michelle's family. This pattern continued for the next few days, with Michelle only leaving the house, accompanied by Clive Manners, to attend the press conference. Then, on the 18th of May at 13:11 p.m, Michelle left on her own, wheeling two huge matching purple suitcases, the type with rigid polycarbonate sides, and loading them into the boot of her white car. 18th of May, the day after she had withdrawn £30,000 in cash from Lola's fund. Philip was observing Rachel's reaction to this.
"Do you need me to keep going?"
he asked.
"I could, only it's going to take me a while to go through 5 months' worth of tape."
Rachel, thinking of Marjorie and Norman hovering obediently in their garden, stood up. "No, that won't be necessary. But obviously this constitutes evidence in the case, and as such could be removed."
Philip looked affronted.
"Perhaps for now you could just send me copies of all the files."
"All of them?"
"All of them, yes. From when you first installed the camera. I'm afraid that's how this works."
He gave a theatrical sigh.
"Of course, Detective Inspector. As I said, I'll do anything I can to help."
Rachel drove south for another 20 miles to HMP Highdown, where Gavin Harper was detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. He walked slowly into the visiting room in prison-issue sweats, his face pale and unshaven.
"I thought you'd got the message," he said belligerently. "I don't sodding know where my daughter is."
Rachel ignored this.
"I'm about to head back to Albufeira," she told him pleasantly. "Thought I'd give you the chance to tell me where to look, save me wasting any more police time."
He gave her a mulish look.
"I'll tell you what's wasting police time. You going back out to Portugal to look for Lola Jade. I've told you, she's not there. 100%. You're not going to find her."
Rachel was not about to tell him that she privately agreed with him, and that the return trip to Albufeira was Patton's idea, not her own.
"Okay, then. Maybe you'd like to tell me how your seminal fluid ended up on the carpet in Lola Jade's room." "I never touched her. I'd never do anything like that. Michelle must have set me up."
"Set you up how?"
Gavin flushed slightly. "Look, I'm not proud of this. But even though we weren't officially together anymore, Michelle and I did still occasionally have sex. We always had a fiery physical relationship. So I'd go round to see Lola or drop her off. We'd have a glass of wine and end up, you know, screwing."
His face reddened further.
"Like I said, I'm not proud of it."
Rachel leaned forward and placed her elbows on the table, getting into his space. "Even if you did, how the hell did your ejaculate end up in your daughter's room?"
"We'd use a condom, and Michelle would deal with it after. I wouldn't put it past her to tip it, the contents, onto Lola's floor."
"And she'd do that because?"
"I tried to tell you before. She wants people to blame me. That's why I took off. She lied to some of her mates that I'd been touching Lola Jade.
you know, in a sexual way. So this would be her twisted way of proving it. Now that I think about it, she was probably only up for a jump for that reason. She was always very quick to produce the rubber, Johnny.
He rubbed his hand wearily over his forehead, as though he had been through this explanation countless times in his mind.
Like I said, it was because of all that that I panicked after they didn't find Lola. It was stupid, I've realised that now.
And Michelle's allegations that you were physically violent to her? His eyes widened.
Seriously? It was more the other way round. She was the one who would chuck things at me, had a vicious temper on her.
So how do you explain this? She opened the photos she had snapped from Michelle's phone of her bruised arms and shoved her own phone across the table at him. He looked at the images. Then something resembling a smile crept across his face.
The date they were taken. Didn't you notice it?
He pushed the phone back and Rachel looked. She'd snapped them hastily and the images were a bit blurred, but the date in the tag could just about be made out.
28th of October 2016.
I'd been in Albufeira about a week by then,
and Michelle's arms are a lot skinnier than that. Those pictures aren't even of her, he sneered. I mean, what kind of a person does something like that just as his credit their kid's dad? She's not fit to be a mother.
Is that why you were suing for custody?
Bloody right it is. And I want you to ask her. Ask her why she's made me out to be a child molester and why she's given you faked pictures.
Oh, I intend to. Don't worry.
And while you're at it, ask Michelle what she did to Ollie. Ask her what she did to our son.
Part 2.
You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow. Khalil Gibran, On Children. Chapter 17. You see your own home through new eyes when someone visits it for the first time, Rachel thought. Howard was at her flat for a personal training session. The consultant had not yet signed her off as fit, but the improvement in her knee was so great she wanted to try running again. The purpose of Howard's home visits was, they both agreed, to make sure she didn't undermine her progress so far. Brickle had once categorized the decor as axe murderer chic. The walls were plain off-white, the furnishings functional, the overall look completely impersonal. True, Brickle's most recent visit had prompted her to order a few things online. A vibrant rug with green and magenta swirls on a cream background, and some framed pop art for the walls in the hallway. She had also brought back some colourful ceramic pots from Portugal and filled them with herbs. As a result, the overall result was less stark than it had been a few weeks ago. And with a concession to the approach of Christmas, she had put up some fairy lights, although she was not really a fairy-light sort of person.
"This is nice,"
said Howard heartily when she let him in, though his face registered faint disappointment.
"Convenient. The location, I mean."
Rachel laughed. "It's okay, I know it looks a bit like a corporate rental. But hey," she gestured around the room, "it's now a corporate rental with fairy lights." Howard put her to work doing some basic stretches. She groaned at her lack of flexibility. "I haven't had a chance to work out in weeks. I've been away on a job for most of November."
"I thought I hadn't seen you in the gym for a while."
He knelt down beside her and grappled her left leg into a hamstring stretch. They made eye contact and he stood up abruptly.
"Right, let's try some sumo squats, see how your knee handles it."
"I was in the Algarve," Rachel told him.
"Fab, bit of winter sun. I thought you were looking tanned."
It wasn't fab at all, as it goes. It was a 3-week exercise in frustration. But the less said about that, the better. After she had worked on stretching and warming up, Howard said,
"How about we do a test run? Just a short one, see how you get on."
"What, now?" He nodded.
"Why not? It may almost be December, but at least it's dry."
"And you'll come with me?"
Of course, all part of the personal training package.
Rachel put on a jacket and a woolen hat, and they headed out into the darkening streets, past sparkling street decorations and festive shop windows. They jogged gently along Jamaica Road and into Southwark Park, completing a circuit of the lake before Howard said she shouldn't push her right leg too far and insisted on her walking back. He came up to her flat with her, which struck her as strictly unnecessary.
"I really need a hot shower," she told him, peeling off her jacket and hat. "So let's pencil a couple more sessions in the diary now, then you can go."
"It's okay. I can wait. I'm not in a rush."
Rachel let her mind play out the sequence. Her, emerging fragrant and glowing from the shower, dressed in nothing but a towel, to find Howard waiting for her on the bed.
"Okay, stop, stop, stop." The image had degenerated into a scene from a generic 70s porn movie. She held up the calendar app on her phone.
"No, let's do it now, then you can get going."
Their eyes met, and she held his gaze just long enough to send him the message that she was tempted. Very tempted. After she had showered and changed into clean sweats, Rachel phoned Brickle, eager to receive a debrief. For over a fortnight, she and a handful of officers, handpicked from the Policia Judiciaria, had combined forces with a specialist search team from Lisbon. This hastily assembled force had combed every back alley of every coastal resort, every waste tip and patch of scrubby ground, and questioned every local or tourist who had seen something suspicious or thought they had sighted Lola Jade. The press had inevitably got wind of their activity, and she spent a lot of her time fending off a stream of calls from journalists. With no concrete news to report, the tabloids had jumped in anyway, with headlines along the lines of UK cops in resort search for Lola Jade body. On the couple of occasions she had flown back to London for the weekend, she had spent most of the time doing laundry and catching up on her sleep, and there had never been a chance to touch base properly with her sergeant. His phone went to voicemail, but he phoned back half an hour later. "All right, Tart." She crooked the phone against her shoulder while she poured herself a glass of red wine, then settled herself on the sofa. "I definitely drew the short straw, Detective Sergeant. Portugal's lovely and everything, but weeks spent combing out-of-season resorts in the rain. I hear you. So where are Surrey Police with Lola Jade now? Give me an update before I get stuck in again." "Good thing I checked up for you, eh? Seeing as I knew it would be the first bloody thing you asked me. They pulled the surveillance unit, after less than 2 weeks, apparently." "What happened?" "Nothing. That's the whole point. They had a unit sat outside Jubilee Terrace round the clock, watching Michelle and Lisa. Michelle came and went from the house, all perfectly above board. She works in a nail salon a few hours a week, but apart from going there and to the shops occasionally, there was nothing suspicious. Before the FSU was abandoned, they got another warrant and did another full search of the Urquhart's house and Willow Way. But again, nothing. NCPA. He quoted the acronym for No Cause for Police Action. "So the unit was stood down. I think CEOP followed up on a couple of leads, one in France and one in North Africa somewhere. One a kid who had actually been trafficked, but both negative for the Harper kid. Patton's calling a combined team meeting soon, but I expect it will just be a formal wind-down." Rachel sighed heavily and pressed her hand to her forehead. "And as I suspected would be the case, we found nothing at all in the Algarve. This could be the end of the road."
"Maybe. Or then again, maybe not." "I can't believe we're doing this. Tell me we're not doing this. We're doing this."
Rachel and Brickle were in his car, parked opposite Lisa Urquhart's house. They both wore dark hats and gloves and were equipped with sleeping bags and a thermos of hot coffee. Every so often, Brickle would fire up the engine as discreetly as he could and briefly fill the car with a blast of hot air from the heater. Even so, it was very cold. They had begun their stakeout at 8:30. There were lights on in the upstairs window, and children's clamour punctuated by raised adult voices. Normal family stuff. A smell of fried food wafted from a part-open downstairs window, mingling with cigarette smoke. At 9 p.m., K
Kevin Urquhart returned from his shift as a baggage handler at Heathrow, parked his light blue VW Passat and went inside. There was more shouting. Then the light from the upstairs room went off. Lisa emerged a few minutes later, bundled up in a fake leopard skin coat.
"Shall we follow her?" Brickle asked.
Rachel shook her head. "Nah, look, she's in her slippers and she's only got a purse with her. She'll be after fags or booze." Sure enough, Lisa shuffled to the corner shop at the end of Jubilee Terrace and returned a couple of minutes later with a packet of cigarettes and a six-pack of beer cans. There was no sign of Michelle Harper.
"How are we going to stay awake?" Brickle grumbled as the digital clock ticked past midnight. "I can feel myself nodding off."
"We're going to have to talk."
"As in, have a conversation?"
"Afraid so."
"Okay, then."
Brickle took a swig of coffee from the neck of the flask, even though Rachel had asked him to use the cup.
"How's your love life? Still making eyes at your hunky personal trainer?"
Rachel let this one go, pulling her fleece jacket up round her neck and rubbing her hands together. "I've got a party coming up, a girls' night." She wagged her fingers in quote marks, simultaneously pulling a face.
"Oh, Christ, that sounds crap."
"I know."
"Anyway, Prince, do you actually have any female friends? I've never heard you mention any, not one."
"Not many," Rachel admitted. "I was never a girly girl." She thought back to her younger self. She had been overweight and bullied, which accounted for many things. Her preoccupation with health and fitness, for one. Her wariness of commitment. There was one female in particular whose persecution had made her swerve her own gender. Lorraine Grassmore. A girl who had pretended to be her friend and to sympathize with her weight struggle, but had really been laughing at her behind her back the whole time. Thinking about her now could still make Rachel inhale forcibly, and she did.
"What?" asked Brickle.
She wasn't about to launch into a sob story about her miserable adolescence, not now, when she was tired and disorientated. "Let's just say I was never part of the popular crowd at school, and then, as you know now, I married very young, and my career took over. There's never been time for the girly stuff."
"Because you're always too busy with men's stuff."
She swatted at him with a gloved hand. "I've nothing against going out for a drink, you know that. But there's something about a bunch of women en masse." She shuddered.
"So you're looking forward to it, then?"
"It's going to be awful." The final light went out on the top floor, and the house lapsed into silence. A cat howled menacingly, followed by a volley of screeches as a fight broke out and a dustbin was knocked over. A dog barked persistently for a couple of minutes, then fell silent. A couple of pubgoers wove their way home down the middle of the street. Brickle fished out a tube of Smarties and swallowed a handful, offering them to Rachel.
"I need to tell you something."
"Go on."
"You know Amber Crowley?"
"The hot lawyer?" He nodded. There was a pause.
"Go on," Rachel repeated, trying to recall a time when she had last seen Brickle looking this worried. It had been a while. "She did something that makes me think that she suspects I made use of her personal information when I shouldn't have done."
Rachel stared at him. "Go on." "Well, you know I found her number on file and texted her to try to get her to go out with me. And maybe I was a little pushy?" He sighed. "It was just meant to be, you know, banter. But she sent me this." He held up his phone, showing her a text. There was no message, just a hyperlink. Rachel took the phone and clicked on it. It took her via a web browser to a site displaying legislative guidelines for Crown prosecutors, specifically offences under Section 55 of the Data Protection Act, which police officers were prone to abuse through their privileged access to the public's personal information.
"Shit," said Rachel.
"I know." "Maybe it's just..." She struggled to find a positive. "As you said, just banter, like a private joke." Brickle looked at her sideways.
"You don't really believe that?"
"Not really, no."
Maybe it's just intended to be a warning to leave her alone.
I suppose. He didn't seem overly reassured.
Whatever happens, for Christ's sake, stay away from her from now on. Promise me?
Promise.
Brickle finished the Smarties, then bundled up his scarf and used it as a pillow, leaning against the door.
Wake me up in a couple of hours, then it'll be your turn to have a kip.